Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
When the cliches are all used up,
the new day is dawning. Sunshine is on the way.
And talk of issues is replaced with unconcealed begging.
Twice. You have taken my political career from what many people thought was a dead end to victory. And I'm going to ask you to do it one more time.
One day more, another day, another destiny.
You know Election Day must be just around the corner. Cornering at top speed, hitting the wall.
One day more.
You know this is the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. 24 hours from now, Americans will be casting ballots at a rate that we haven't seen perhaps since 1908. Adora Udoji is on assignment in Georgia. We're looking at the battleground border of Pennsylvania and Ohio, and we have some advice for responsible partying tomorrow night, win or lose. Those stories coming up, but first some headlines. Last call for John McCain.
The pundits have written us off just like they've done before. My friends, the Mac is back.
And so was the Palin. She was campaigning in Ohio.
If you want to get ahead and you believe that America is the land of possibilities, and if you don't want your dreams dashed by the Obama tax increase plans, then Ohio, we're asking for your vote.
Obama met her Canton, Ohio, and raised her a Cleveland.
I've got to tell you, the last couple of days, I've been just feeling good.
And Joe Biden was in Ohio also.
We need to unite this country because you cannot lead a world as a divided nation. You cannot revive the middle class as a divided country. You cannot do it when one part of the country is pitted against the other.
It's amazing that any of these candidates know what part of the country they're in at any moment. They all have multiple states on their dance cards today. Femi, what are the other headlines?
Hello there, John. The Supreme Court hears a closely watched case about drug warnings today, and it will determine to what extent drug companies can be held responsible after the FDA deems a drug safe. Newly promoted American commander General David Petraeus visits Pakistan, and that country's foreign minister has criticized recent US missile strikes there. UN medical aid is on the way to Congolese refugees on the run from intense fighting between rebels and the government. Aid workers plan another convoy of food aid tomorrow. And most European markets are up just a little bit at this hour after solid gains in Asian markets. Futures trading predicts a flat opening on Wall Street in just a little while.
It's been a little while since we've had such a quiet market day, don't you think?
Very quiet.
Very, very quiet. And also the strike at Boeing is over.
Yes,
that's
over.
Report over
8 weeks that lasted.
Indeed. One more day until the 2008 election. We've been asking for one phrase from you to sum up the past 2 years. We've gotten tons of them. And you can vote for the slogans that have already been submitted on our website. We're also talking about early voters. America's exit poll is open. If you're one of them, tell us your story. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Slogan or your exit poll experience or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Call us, won't you? It's democracy, after all.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Hard to believe, Patrick, we made it.
We did.
We are here. It is the Monday before the day of the election 2008.
And just think, just 20 months ago, there was one name on everyone's lips. Dennis Kucinich.
Dennis Kucinich, that's right. Where are they now? Actually, that's our show tomorrow. Where are they now? Patrick Henry Bass is with us. Dorya Doge is out in Georgia, the recently anointed toss-up state in this topsy-turvy, crazy 2008 election. This is a moment of anticipation.
It truly is. It's a cliffhanger.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's a cliffhanger. It's a historical cliffhanger. What will be the history that is made tomorrow? I think that's really the question.
Either way, history will be made.
Indeed. That is correct. And the history that will be made will have to do with simple voters in places like Pittsburgh and Lisbon, Ohio, making a very quiet personal decision.
I've become cynical about what the Republican Party can do. I feel like the Republican Party has left me.
No Obama in the White House, so that's my opinion.
No Obama?
No Obama.
You don't like him?
No.
We're going to take you now into the deepest of the battleground domain of America, across a hotly contested border between Pennsylvania and Ohio. It's a place that goes from black to white and black again. It goes from middle class to not so middle class and back again. And it goes from the Rust Belt to the new tech economy tentatively. It is the place that is completely in play in this election. We don't know if Eastern Pennsylvania or Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio will be decisive in election, but we do know that all of those voters are in play and are hotly contested by the candidates. And Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein has journeyed through Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio for us. She joins us now to take the pulse of perhaps the front line in this battleground. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John.
So where are you exactly and why?
Well, I'm in Pittsburgh, and yesterday I drove from Pittsburgh in Allegheny County in western Pennsylvania out to Columbiana County in eastern Ohio. Now, Columbiana County is a red county. It is tiny, and yet John McCain has been there. Joe Biden has been there. This is not a place that is being ignored. And just to give you a sense of what it's like, I was driving from Pittsburgh to Columbiana County down Route 30, and the one radio station that I could get in was playing the Dixie Chicks. So they are back on the radio, on country radio. There are a lot of signs for fishing, for hunting. People are selling fish. They're selling, one sign said, Farwood, not to be condescending about it. That was F-A-R-W-O-O-D. But, I mean, this is really poor
subsistence
area.
I get it.
Exactly. So you'd expect to see a lot of McCain-Palin signs in this area. And I did, but what surprised me is not too far from that sign, I saw an Obama-Biden sign. I saw some big Obama-Biden signs out in the hay fields in this area. And I drove into Lisbon, Ohio, a small old town, a beautiful old town, you know, real Americana, where they've got the bunting in the hardware store. And I stopped at the steel trolley diner for lunch and sat down with the guy that identified himself as Bob the Roofer and his friend John. And I thought that I was going to expect what they were going to tell me. They were just finishing up their apple pie. But listen to Bob and then listen to John. What he says may surprise you a little bit.
And what do you think about Senator Obama?
I don't like the crowd he keeps. Let's see, who's for him? Hamas is for him. Ahmadinejad or whatever that idiot's name is, they're for him. They can't wait for him to win. So that tells me I don't think he's real American. His wife's not proud to be an American, so I am. I don't like him. Not because he's black. No, I have more power to him. I'm glad he got where he did. But just a little Harvard boy. I like Sarah Palin, who is she's one of us.
You guys disagree.
I voted for Bush. Bush didn't do what he was supposed to do. How can you vote for somebody like that? And McCain's just a follower. You know, that's his buddy. He's going to follow the same thing. Gas prices went out of sight. I was in the gas business for 40 years, so I know all about it.
You mean in gasoline? You had a service station, or
yes, I had a service station.
What happened?
Well, people come in and started selling gasoline 25 cents a gallon and up below what I paid for it, put you out of business.
So there we are in Lisbon, Ohio, and we've got two Republicans strongly disagreeing over who they're going to vote for. It suggests that Republican support in this supposed red stronghold is pretty soft.
Yeah, I mean, even in Columbiana County at the Democratic Party headquarters, the head of the volunteer effort there was a two-time Bush supporter. And, you know, these are the people that Hillary Clinton, you know, called the so-called hardworking Americans, the white Americans that were voting for her and that she was arguing Barack Obama was never going to get. But when you listen to a little bit more of what John has to say, you see that, in fact, he seems to have got them.
Can't say that the black people are not American. The black people are American as you are, as I am. You know, we come to this country, we're foreigners. They come to this country, they're foreigners. You have to take them for what they are now. They are here. And, you know, if you're prejudiced of them, I don't think that's a very good way of doing things. If prejudice is what's going to keep him out of office, then well, this is not a free country anymore then.
Do you think it will?
No, I don't. I think he's your next president.
Well, you can hear the journey in those words. Patrick, what do you think of that guy?
Wow. I mean, yeah, he's awesome. Really. I mean, what's the name of the county again, Andrea?
It's Columbiana County. It's a county that, you know, does have some Democrats, but went pretty heavily for Bush in 2004 and 2000. And, you know, it's the kind of place that I sort of pretty much expected to find a lot of people who said, I'm voting the Bible, and I did. And a lot of people who said, I'm voting gun rights, and I did.
But it's amazing all the journeys that we're finding here. I mean, there's a lot of unexpected stuff that comes out of the voters that we've met in these counties that count, but everybody has a journey from one place ideologically to another. You also went to Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, I went to Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, which is the home of Pittsburgh. Now, you know, I've heard a lot of sort of, you know, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, they're Democratic. Well, Pittsburgh is not Philadelphia. I mean, unlike Philadelphia, has a very small African-American population. It's also the home of Teresa Heinz Kerry. So there's a reason why this area might have gone pretty strongly for Kerry. When I was here last summer, you might remember some of the voters were saying, well, I was a Hillary Clinton voter, but I really like John McCain because he's a kind of Democrat, kind of a Republican. And, you know, there's a big question. People look at the polls. They see in areas like this, there's still lots of undecided voters. And there's all kinds of arguments going on about, well, how are those undecideds going to go? And are they going to just all go vote for McCain because they're too afraid to tell people that they're not? And there may be some people that will. But there might be people like Lynn, a stay-at-home mother, who said she always votes, but she's not voting this year.
So what was it that this year that sort of turned you off?
Well, there's things about each candidate that I don't like. Like, there's policies of John McCain's that I don't support, and I don't want that in the White House. But there's something about Obama that I don't like, and I can't put my finger on it.
Now, what do you think that is, this Lynn Finger woman? Is she weary of this campaign and that's what we're hearing? Or is she somebody who the Republicans should have been able to attract, you know, her to them?
I certainly think that John McCain saw in moms like Lynn a path to victory. But there's been all
home,
of this negativity.
Fatal.
There's been so much on the radio. You know, they're running in Pennsylvania this ad with excerpts of the Reverend Wright's speeches. I mean, it has been intense. It's been the land of the robocalls. And what's happened is people like Lynn are just saying, look, I don't like them. I don't like the economy. I'm not going to bother.
But there got to be some people with smiles on their faces in this battleground zone that we sent you to.
Well, of course. And just coming off the kidney walk yesterday, I spoke to
kidney
a woman
walk?
Who's the kidney walk, yes, the you know, walk for the Kidney Foundation.
Uh-huh.
I ran into a mom named Suzanne who was there with her four children. She'd actually personally donated a kidney. And she said that she was absolutely voting Obama, and it had a lot to do with her personal experience.
Personally, what I've been through in the last 4 years, losing a business, losing my home, having to declare bankruptcy, pretty much going through everything they've talked about. Personally, I don't feel sorry for somebody who makes more than $250,000 a year having to give up a little bit more.
Not sorry for Joe the plumber. Andrea Bernstein, thanks so much for being with us in the battleground state of Pennsylvania and the state of Ohio. We've got Andrea's full unedited interview with Bob and John and all the other folks on our website, thetakeaway.org. And you can track all of Andrea's reporting from the counties that count with our interactive map, all on Election Day.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Takeaway contributor and Essence senior editor Patrick Henry Bass.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. How's your Dickens these days?
Pretty good.
You got a literary suggestion for getting through these tough times or even thinking about it? You know, actually, it's hard to have any detachment about what's going on because we're right in it right now.
Yeah, I was thinking it was the best of times, the worst of times, and somewhere in between.
That's Dickens from Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Sometimes the cliche, though, hits the mark, don't you think?
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
More?
Of course, for years, Hollywood has been making musical fun out of the miseries of 18th century England. And of course, Charles Dickens himself, the author, made a fortune from writing about his own personal misfortunes in that terrible time of Victorian and industrial revolutionary England. Joining us now is Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst. He's a professor of English at the University of Oxford and joins us to discuss whether Dickens is a pretty good window to take a look at the own economic troubles that we are going through. Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst, thanks for joining us.
Very good to be here.
It's great to have you on because when I knew you were going to be on the program, it occasioned me going over to my bookshelf and taking down all of my favorite Dickens and really going through what I found to be a treasure trove of references and scenes. And first of all, what are some of your favorite Dickens books which really perhaps bear relevance to what's going on today?
Well, I suppose one of the good things about Dickens is that he contains so much. There's a whole imaginative world there, which is like the one we live in, but also weirdly at odds with it. And that means that you can pick up almost anything that he writes, and you'll find something in it that has relevance today. So, for instance, the idea of poverty as bearing a kind of social stigma. Betty Higden, a character in Our Mutual Friend, springs to mind there. She prefers to go and die rather than go to the workhouse.
Can I give you a quote from there? This is from Our Mutual Friend. Pa, think how terrible the fascination of money is. I see this and hate this and dread this and don't know but that money might make a much worse change in me, and yet I have money always in my thoughts and my desires, and the whole life I place before myself is money, 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 and what money can make of life.
I mean, that could be Dickens talking about himself as well.
Indeed.
I mean, this is a man who left £93,000 when he died, so comfortably a millionaire in Victorian money. And when he wrote Scrooge, in some ways, in some of his letters, he said that it was a self-parody. The difference, I suppose, is that his fascination with money is one that allowed him to do good with it. He recognised that money is good for nothing unless you recognise that it can do more than simply buy stuff in the shops. And I suppose the idea of value is one that he comes back to again and again. Again, this seems to be a sort of fascination for him. What should you value? And in fact, is it possible to value money too much? And that's, of course, one of the stories behind Our Mutual Friend.
And one of the stories behind the financial crisis right now. You value money too much, and then it becomes worthless. Talk about Little Dorrit, the story about really perhaps the most autobiographical scene of Dickens' young life, and that is when his family was actually in a debtor's prison in England.
That's right.
And he had to work to support them.
That's right. Now, his father, John Dickens, was slightly feckless when it came to money, and he was imprisoned in the Marshalsea for 14 weeks. And he was released under the what was then the Insolvent Debtors Act. But in the meantime, young Dickens, Charles Dickens, was working in a blacking warehouse, sticking labels on bottles. And he thought that it had broken his heart. He thought that it had reduced him from the status of a gentleman to just what he called a common labouring drudge. And you do get very strange echoes of that in Little Dorrit, where Little Dorrit, the heroine, is grown up, but she's very, very small. She's weirdly worldly, but she's also extremely innocent. And it's like a strange hybrid of Dickens's child self and his adult self coming into contact on the page.
Well, it's deeply psychological because Little Dorrit was born in the Marshalsea and has a kind of a longing for the home of this place that is so associated with humiliation and pain. Mm. And this is sort of the way that, in which Dickens kind of weaves this notion of failure financially with failure morally. And the ability to separate those two becomes the way out. And I'm wondering if we're grappling with some of those things today.
I think that's absolutely right. One of the things that Dickens tried to do in some of his early novels was to restore an old-fashioned link between money and morality. So Oliver Twist, for instance, is born, like Little Dorrit, in poverty and more or less in captivity in the workhouse. But he is showered with riches and the revelation that he is indeed a true-born gentleman at the end of the novel. So there seems to be some kind of reward for virtue, as if he was a character in a fairy tale. Little Dorrit is interesting, though, because, as you say, the house is the prison, and the prison is the home. And it's one of the many times in Dickens where homes are shown to be peculiarly vulnerable places. They're precious, but they're also deeply precarious places. And the novels are full of houses which, well, they either fall down, like Mrs. Clennam's house in Little Dorrit, or like Wemmick's house in Great Expectations.
Sure.
They seem ready to collapse at any moment. And of course, the novels are full of homeless characters, often children. Like Little Nell, the old curiosity shop, Oliver Twist, Joe in Bleak House, children who have been abandoned by society and left to roam the streets, exactly as Dickens himself thought that he was going to.
This is Patrick Henry Bass here. You just brought up the Bleak House, and talk about some of the complications of the money with the orphan in the Bleak House. I was thinking about that when, you know, with the $700 billion bailout, you know, will ordinary people ever see that money? I'm struck by that in the orphans there in Bleak House.
I mean, money for Dickens, I mean, throughout his career is complex, and it allows him to write these incredibly complex plots in which we get lost along with the characters. But at the same time, Bleak House is a very good example. He offers us a sort of bird's eye view. He shows us what it's like to see the world in a way that ordinary people don't see it, and to escape from it. So you're absolutely right that the plot of Bleak House and the financial machinations and the complexities and the tangle of red tape that snarls up people's lives is absolutely extraordinarily produced on the page. The difference is, I suppose, that there is a way out in a plot, in a novel, as there might not be for real people.
Well, Professor Fairhurst, you know, put aside Dickens' skill as a writer, his ability to create a cliffhanger, because he did write serialized, you know, weekly installments, so he had to have a certain amount of skill as a writer. But just in terms of this material, why did it hit such a chord? Why is it so timeless, these novels of misery and failure?
Yeah, I mean, it smacks of what Ezra Pound said when he pointed out that good literature is news that stays news. I mean, in 1825, when Dickens was a teenager, the Bank of England almost failed.
Right.
It had advanced too much money, too cheaply, to too many businesses who were speculating.
There we go. Another echo. Professor, can we just fly you over here and have you be on the show every week? Thanks so much. Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst is a fellow and tutor at Magdalen College in Oxford, talking about Dickens' news that stays news. Patrick, top that.
I can't.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Femi, do you think Boy George listens to our show?
If he's allowed out on parole, yes.
On our site, someone named B. George offered a slogan for the campaign, Reconomics, he calls it.
Okay.
Rich M. sent us an email, these are my parties and I'll cry if I want to. All you have to do is pick up the phone, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us a slogan. What'd you have, a tough Halloween weekend or something? Too much partying? Come on. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want some more slogans or my take at thetakeaway.org. Headlines from Femi Okay.
Thanks, John. The time is 27 minutes to the top of the hour. British PM Gordon Brown says that Arab states should have a greater say in the IMF in return for making bigger contributions. He's in the Middle East now trying to gather funds from oil-rich countries to help ailing economies. Both candidates are on whirlwind tours for the final day of campaigning. John McCain will go through 7 swing states, beginning in Florida and ending in his home state of Arizona. Barack Obama is sticking to the East Coast and he'll hit Florida, North Carolina and Virginia. An 8-week-long strike against the Boeing Corporation is over. The Machinists Union ratified a new contract this weekend and it offers greater job security to thousands of workers. Eastern Congo is receiving its first humanitarian aid since fighting began there in August. The UN convoy went behind rebel lines to bring food to the 250,000 refugees displaced from their homes. And a poor old vice president candidate Sarah Palin has been taken in by a prank phone call in which a Canadian comedian posed as the French president Nicolas Sarkozy. He said that his aide was Johnny Halliday. He asked if she wanted to go seal hunting. At the end of the 6-minute call, he actually revealed it was a prank and actually owned up.
And this audio is posted somewhere, probably?
Oh, it's everywhere. On the prank call, and Palin will probably take you to it directly.
Thank you. It's amusing.
Thank you, Femi. Can't believe it.
Public
service
from our news headline reader. Thank you, Femi. Okay.
You're very welcome.
All right, it is a moment of hypervigilance here in the campaign. What are the issues facing voters tomorrow as we expect a tsunami of turnout? Adam Skaggs, a lawyer for New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, is on the case and with us here in the studio to talk about some of those problems. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You know, let's talk first of all about vote suppression. It seems to be the phenomenon that has the highest numbers associated with it, and we'll get to issues of fraud later. When we talk about vote suppression, we're talking about lines too long, deliberate efforts to maybe keep people away from the polls. What are you watching, and how are maybe some of those vote suppression techniques that have traditionally worked in the past nullified by the kind of overwhelming turnout that we're suspecting is going to happen tomorrow?
Well, I think there's been some progress, and obviously there are some things to watch on that front. First, the progress. There have been a number of attempts over the past several weeks to outright disqualify voters, kick them off the voter rolls, or erect hurdles that will make it difficult for them to cast a ballot that's counted.
You're referring to some of the stuff that the New York Times has reported, Ian Urbino talking about the checking of lists against Social Security addresses and nullifying people's
That's
names.
Exactly right. That's right. Part of it. There have been a number of different ways of going about this. There have been attempts to reject voter registration applications or voter ballot applications based on missing check marks. And by and large, a lot of this 11th-hour litigation that's been brought to try and stop voters from getting out and getting their ballots counted has been unsuccessful. So that's been a positive development. But, of course, that's not the only way to prevent voters from voting, and some of the issues you just mentioned are things we really need to watch carefully tomorrow, particularly infrastructure issues, long lines, insufficient allocation of voting machines and ballots, so that voters that actually get out and show up at the polls may not be able to cast ballots. So that's something we're very concerned about.
Where do we look for problems particularly? Is there a location that matters most to you?
Well, I think obviously, we want voters to be able to show up and vote without waiting in line for hours across the country. That's obviously the goal. Historically, some of the places where we've seen the longest lines and some of the biggest issues with allocation of resources is in urban communities. And so those are places we're going to be watching. And we're going to be watching particularly in states like Virginia and Pennsylvania, which are important swing states in which there are signs that there may be issues. Pennsylvania has had no early voting, so everybody that's going to vote in person at least will be doing so tomorrow. That's a concern. In Virginia, you've already seen litigation over the past couple of weeks in which the NAACP and other groups have sued and said there has been an insufficient allocation of machines and ballots to particularly urban and minority voting districts. So in both of these places, we're going to have to watch this very carefully. All of this will be exacerbated, of course, by the unprecedented turnout that we expect. Already through early voting and through all of the polling and the registration numbers, every sign points to there being more voters coming out and casting ballots in this election than we've ever seen before.
What about Ohio? Sorry, Tom.
Let me just throw one thing in. We got stats that 24% have already voted. That's the turnout so far. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, what about Ohio, which you know was so critical in the 2004 election, especially the urban counties there? Have they worked out their issues there?
Well, there are a lot of things we're going to be watching in Ohio. The good news is that they have made a lot of progress. They have passed some reforms so that they have emergency paper ballots on hand in every polling place, urban as well as rural areas, so that if the lines get too long, if the machines break down and start to slow things down, they will have emergency paper ballots on hand, and that should facilitate moving things along pretty quickly. But, of course, there are a number of other issues. John, you just mentioned 24% of early voting. In some states, we've got more than half the number of voters that voted in the entire election in 2004 who have already cast ballots.
Wow.
In Colorado, we have almost 70% of those who cast ballots in 2004 who have already voted.
Get out. In California, it's already 70%?
I'm sorry, in Colorado.
In Colorado.
In California, we've had more than 3 million early votes. In Texas, more than 3 million early votes. Almost 3 million in North Carolina, almost 4 million in Florida.
What's the chance we're going to get to the end of Election Day and have more people who have voted than we have on the list?
Well, I don't think that's a concern.
Good.
I
then
think
we'll just leave it right there.
I think what we'll definitely see, though, is more people than have ever voted in a presidential election and certainly than voted in the last one.
How keen are the candidates and the campaigns on watching key precincts where voter suppression might be decisive? And is that something you welcome or you just soon doesn't happen?
Well, I think first to answer the first question, it's off the charts. I mean, there is going to be an army of lawyers, dispatch, and observers, non-legal
by both sides.
Observers by both sides. Yeah. And not only by both campaigns, but also by nonprofit groups, nonpartisan groups like the Brennan Center and others that are going to be sending observers out to make sure that if issues do arise, they're quickly and promptly addressed, and obviously to try and stop them in the first place. I think that's a good thing. I think oversight is welcome here. Obviously, there's a concern that this intense attention that's being paid will lead to partisan manipulation and will lead to voter challenges.
There are levers that are hard to resist, that's for sure. Unfortunately, we have to go. Can we call you on Wednesday to find out how things went?
Well, let's hope they go well, and I'd be happy to talk about it.
And we're happy about that. Adam Skaggs is a lawyer for New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, definitely watching the mechanisms and the levers of the election tomorrow, and always thank you, Adam. Now, we want to talk to you about what you think of this election. It's been 20 months of an amazing campaign, as you've heard there. It's going to be off the charts in terms of numbers. We need a slogan, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Well, how will history remember this? You have a chance to be a part of it. Also, if you have voted already and would like to be a part of America's exit poll, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or just email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Now, if you live under a rock, maybe you don't know that tomorrow is Election Day. But in fact, there are places in the United States where the campaign doesn't have very much impact, and it's difficult for the light of the political sun that is emanating from both of these campaigns, Barack Obama and John McCain, to actually penetrate. And, you know, we thought we would look into a place where maybe the presidential campaign has not really been much of an issue for a few moments. Joining us now is Jeffrey Merrill, who's warden of Maine State Prison. Warden, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Maine and Vermont, I want to point out to our listeners, are the only two states in the country that allow convicted felons to vote while in prison. So in theory, there are voters in play at the prisons in Maine and in Vermont. How does that play in your facility, Warden Merrill?
Well, the prisoners, if they want to participate in the voting process, then they have to request by themselves. They have to do it themselves, initiate it themselves, to get an absentee ballot from the residence of the last known residence where they lived prior to incarceration. And they have to do the work themselves and get the ballot inside and complete it and then return it.
Now, do you get any sense that prisoners care about this sort of thing, even if they do watch television and see political ads and have a sense of the campaign?
The reality is they have that right, but they very, very few exercise that right.
You know, it's not ironic. I mean, of course, these are people whose very lives are dependent upon the government, and yet they don't necessarily feel they have any kind of a stake in terms of their vote. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of it is just the fact that they have to do all the work to do it. I mean, they have to request it, and they have to complete it, and they have to follow through. So I think they talk about it some, but I don't think they really want to spend the time or the effort.
Now, the NAACP did an educational project in your prison during this campaign cycle. Can you describe what that was about?
Yeah, the prisoners in Maine have always had the right to vote, and they were concerned that the prisoners weren't really fully aware of how to do that, how to approach it. So they asked if they could come in and just explain the voting process and encourage them to exercise that right. And they did do that. There was a group that came in. We have an active NAACP group within the prison. And so they came in and had an opportunity to brief the prisoners on that, to reiterate the program and the process that we had established and encourage them to participate.
Any sensitivity on your part to getting your staff involved in the political campaign one way or another?
No. I mean, the staff, they don't engage in conversations in between their political views and that of the prisoner.
I see. Any sense? What is your facility?
It's a maximum security prison. I have actually two prisons that I'm the warden over, and I've got a medium and a minimum security facility and a max, and I've got about 1,200 prisoners.
Now, any just sort of gut sense of whether they're, you know, McCain or Obama?
No, not really.
Come on.
I think that they...
Getting this kind of candor out of a warden, I know, this early in the morning, it's, I'm barking up the wrong tree here, you think?
Yeah.
Come on, a little bit.
But they do have a lot of chat because they have televisions that they purchase themselves for the money they've earned. And so they monitor and they watch it. But,
and they'll be watching the returns tomorrow night. Jeffrey Merrill, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Jeffrey Merrill is the warden of Maine State Prison, where prisoners can vote.
But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antonio.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Of live headlines and dead languages, Femi Oke is here.
Thank you very much.
What does that mean?
That was a very nice tease.
Yes,
you teasing.
I'm teasing your headlines.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Polls are tight in key states as we kick off the final day of campaigning. All four nominees visit multiple cities in several states before tomorrow's vote. And step up, that's UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown's message to the next president, whoever wins. Speaking at an oil conference in the Middle East, Brown urged the US to show more leadership on economics and not be protectionist. Ease back, and that's what Pakistan is telling a top American commander. The Pakistani defense minister warned the top US commander there that recent American strikes on militants are stoking anti-American feeling. Syria shut down an American school in retaliation to an American raid on its soil. The strike targeted what's thought to be a network smuggling foreign fighters into Iraq. And South Africa has a new political party. Those angry at Thabo Mbeki's ousting have broken off from the ruling African National Congress Party, and new elections are due next spring.
And finally, some local governments in the UK have ordered their staff not to use any more Latin words, either in documents or dealing with the public, because they say that not everybody understands Latin. Now, Dr. Peter Jones works for a charity called Friends of Classics, and he's gone through some of the words that would have to be shelved.
Alibi, alias, annus horribilis, apparatus, exit, facsimile, habeas corpus, ignoramus, insignia, interim, omnibus, par.
So you get an idea, par, percent, etc. Alternative words that the councils are offering up. Instead of status quo, we could say state of things. And instead of ad hoc, we could say for this special purpose. But scholars of classics have called the ban in the language ethnic cleansing.
And Latin Corner there with Femi. Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
So one day to go before Election Day. How are you going to remember the past 2 years? We're asking for your slogans.
Who's going to win the election? How will our economy survive? Who will pay for what they've done to our economy and our country? This is Christy from South Jersey. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I.
Everybody's so earnest out there. And you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and see all of the entries and vote on your favorites and add your own. There's some pretty great ones on there. We're also asking voters and early voters what's going through their minds as they make their way to the poll.
Hello, this is Tim, a Democrat from New York. I'm holding my nose now, and I'll be holding my nose on Tuesday and voting for John McCain.
Call us with your slogans and stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We still have Patrick Henry Bass with us, but also joining us now is the co-host of this program, the co-host of The Takeaway from Atlanta, Georgia. Adora, what are you doing down there in Georgia?
This is The Takeaway Southern Perch. We're down here in Georgia. We're going to be watching everything that's happening with the election tomorrow, the voting, not only here in Georgia, but also in North Carolina and Kentucky and Mississippi, where there are some major races. And it's extraordinary because this morning, the Fulton County officials, this is one of the largest counties in the state, they're really concerned because of the record turnout. I mean, we had a number of people on the show, John, last week and the week before, who were talking about how they were waiting 2, 4, 6, 8 hours to vote in early voting. 1.99 million people voted in Georgia, just in Georgia, in early voting. And that's 60% of the total who voted in 2004.
That's amazing. That is amazing. You know, I have one assignment for you. It's a little one. I know you're going to be busy down there. Can you go find that guy, Andrew Kupka, you know, the undecided voter?
We are all over that.
I just want you to watch him like a hawk. If he decides, you got to be there, okay?
The minute he gets that twinkle in his eye, John, we're going to call you.
We got a twinkle cam. Thank you, Adora. Adora Udoji, the co-host of The Takeaway, down in the toss-up state, surprising, of Georgia.
Can't believe it.
Covering the 2008 election, she will be on the air live tomorrow from, as she calls it, the Southern Perch. So are you planning an Election Day party tomorrow night? What do you think? Is it a slumber party? I guess 2000 was a slumber party. Maybe people didn't want it that way. Is it a tailgate party? We wanted to give you some tips for how to responsibly set up an election night party. And joining us now is Stefan Boublil, who's the founder of The Apartment, a kind of lifestyle and design agency. Stefan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Hello, Patrick, and hello, John.
Hello.
And Elizabeth Lane Lawley is in Rochester, New York. She's an associate professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, where they have some party concerns of their own. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth, let me begin with you. You're trying to design a nonpartisan party. What are your suggestions for people who are trying to do this on a smaller scale?
Well, we're in an interesting position because, you know, we're on a college campus, and we're going to be having the party on the college campus. And as someone who has to teach and grade the students, I don't want to put them in a position where having an idea that disagrees with mine is going to make them feel that their grade might be at risk. So we've always done this in a nonpartisan way. For me, that means, you know, really making it clear when we send out invitations and make announcements about it that everyone is welcome at this regardless of their partisan leanings.
Stefan, it's a little different in your neck of the woods there, right?
Yeah, well, we're going to be doing something extremely partisan. We're actually going to be going for Obama all the way and be able to hopefully respect and honor three of his sides, his Kenyan side, and have some food there from the Kirikiu tribe, which is Kenyan's most popular ethnic group, and be able to cook some irio or mokimo, which is really a mixture of beans that comes in two colors. For his Hawaiian part, we'll be having some lau lau, which is an authentic Hawaiian entree. And, of course, for the Chicago part, we'll be having some cupcakes with Oprah frosting.
Now, you don't have any, like, quesadillas on ice in case you're going to have to come up with some Arizona cuisine in a hurry, right?
That's going to be more like Coca-Cola and Mars bars, which are going to be really the last taste of America before, I guess, we flee to Canada.
And what about some moose?
Ah, the moose. That's probably right. That's for the next part of our journey.
So I guess, what are you thinking in terms of the late night here? I mean, this could be over really early, or are you prepared for it going, you know, way into the wee hours, Stefan?
We're prepared for this to be quite early. From the polls that have been coming out lately, we're looking at some nice Dom Perignon corking, I think, probably early in the evening. I'm hoping that way we can drink even more and wake up with a sense of a new America.
A responsible citizen there, Stefan Bublil.
Yeah,
Elizabeth Lawley, how do you keep a party like this from getting raucous? I mean, at a college, there are strong views, and you're up there in upstate New York, where I imagine it's not very one-sided.
No, in fact, it's not particularly one-sided in our part of the country, nor with our students, who tend to be a more conservative than usual mix of young people. But we have done this in the past, and we really haven't had a lot of trouble. I mean, it helps that we're having it on the academic side of campus. We're having it in a building that they think of as, you know, sort of not their personal space. If we were doing this in the dorms, or if there was alcohol involved, I suspect it would be a very different kind of vibe. But
so no streaking and no free beer at this point.
No free
right.
beer, indeed. Yeah. We're having it in the conference room. There will be pizza and soda, but there will be no beer.
What about Cheetos? What about Cheetos?
We encourage people to bring their junk food of choice. So this is a grassroots, grounds-up kind of party, not a carefully orchestrated and catered affair.
All right, and big-screen TVs for both, I suspect. Elizabeth Lane Lawley, thanks so much for joining us from Rochester, New York. She's an associate professor at Rochester Institute of Technology. And Stefan, have a rockin' time.
Thank you very much. And if I can say, you know, how can you have a presidential election without streaking? That just seems crazy to me. But.
Responsible citizen Stefan Bublil in New York City, founder of the Apartment, a lifestyle and design agency. Thank you, Stefan. And democracy is a beautiful thing. We are always on at The Takeaway. With just one day left to go in this political campaign, we're asking how you'd sum up all the good times in just one phrase.
Hi, my name is Blaise Corrigan from Brooklyn. My take is, no more would we wait. Vote change in 08.
Or how about Joanne, who writes the good, the bad, and the ugly? Or Renee, who sent us an email, election 2008, from the sublime to the ridiculous. Bob tells us his two words that will remind him of the election, wrong woman. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org, and you can see all the suggestions and vote for them too at vote2008.thetakeaway.org. Right now, the number one way to sum up the election, it's the stupid economy. And here's your takeaway.
Yeah, it smacks of what Ezra Pound said when he pointed out that good literature is news that stays news.
Man, you gotta love that. That's Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst. He's a professor of English at the University of Oxford, talking about the timeless classics of Charles Dickens, all still relevant today in the midst of our economic turmoil. We are always on at thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything this morning, it's on our website, and we have up-to-the-minute campaign coverage in our podcast. Starting tomorrow morning, you can subscribe now on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
One day more. Another day.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
voter Andrew Kupka. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, John?
I'm just fine. Are you still undecided down there in Atlanta?
I am still undecided as of this morning, yes.
So I guess you've got a job to do today, right?
I am reassessing and giving it a lot of thought.
Anything that happened over the weekend sway you at all? Anything?
There was an Obama ad that I didn't particularly like.
Did you see any McCain or Obama masks out there among the trick-or-treaters on Friday night?
There were one or two, yes, and a Sarah Palin or two in the crowd as well.
More Obama masks, though, right?
Yeah, maybe one or two, yeah.
Andrew, can I call you Andy?
No, you still have to call me Andrew.
Okay, Andrew. So we're so concerned about this prolonged episode of indecision on your part that we've decided to send a team of producers and my co-host Adora Udoji down to Atlanta to make sure we're there when the light bulb goes off. Are you okay with that?
Absolutely looking forward to that.
We're going to be with you to the bitter end, Andrew, okay?
And I with you.
And we've even got a theme for you. An exit poll gone wild. Kupka's got bupkis. He's still undecided.
Undecided, hey.
You know it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. What will Andrew Kupka do after this election? Well, we will examine that question and also focus on Congress and some eloquent trailblazing campaigns from history that blazed a trail for what's been going on in 2008. Those stories coming up. But first, these headlines. Candidates will wear out their throats and increase their carbon footprint, burning jet fuel today. All four nominees have lots of speeches in lots of cities. Yesterday, Barack Obama was in Ohio.
We've been through an 8-year storm. But a new day is dawning. Sunshine is on the way.
Joe Biden was also a Buckeye.
We need to unite this country because you cannot lead a world as a divided nation. You cannot revive the middle class as a divided country. You cannot do it when one part of the country is pitted against the other.
John McCain was among friends in New Hampshire.
Twice you have taken my political career from what many people thought was a dead end to victory. And I'm going to ask you to do it one more time.
And one more time, Sarah Palin was in Ohio.
The time for choosing is near. Ohio, are you ready to help us carry your state to victory?
Well, don't tell the people at the Fox Network, but there are other news stories besides the campaign. Femi Oke is here to tell us all about it in the remaining seconds.
Hello,
I hogged everything there, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Thanks for saving it and continuing to talk. The Supreme Court hears a closely watched case about drug warnings today, and it will determine to what extent drug companies can be held responsible after the FDA seems to deem drugs as drug safe. That's all I've got time for, John. Is that okay?
Yeah, well, we got the market. We got the market in a half hour, and it looks like a flat open. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
One more day. Give us your slogan, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And also, early voters come to America's exit poll at the same place.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. However you look at it, whatever your ideology is, whatever your partisan allegiance is, history will be made tomorrow, and we have one day today to think about it and to watch the last moments of the campaign. With me is Daniel Patrick Henry Bass. Why do I want to call you Daniel Henry?
I'm Daniel Bone Bass.
Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence and our Takeaway contributor. He's here in the studio with me. Adora Udoji is down in Georgia, which surprisingly is a toss-up state.
It's up in the air.
You know, I was reading the New York Times this morning, and their discussion of the congressional races that are at stake around the country make it hard not to draw the conclusion that the wheels have really come off the GOP, at least in terms of what they're going to be able to do in Congress. Forget the White House. David Herzenhorn joins us. He's a New York Times reporter. He's from the Washington Bureau. David, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John.
It is hard to see a positive in this campaign for the GOP in Congress. Is it really as bad as some of the numbers might suggest?
Well, the numbers are certainly bad. And the interesting thing, of course, is that everybody's been distracted by the presidential race. And they don't realize that this has been going on, building slowly, you know, not just even in the last couple weeks, but over months and even more than a year, as the number of Republicans retiring from the House, you know, just continued to grow and grow. And so, you know, the most interesting numbers, I think, in our story today are just about the money. The campaign committees, the Senate campaign committee, the Democrats have spent basically twice as much as the Republicans, and on the House side, it's more than three times as much to help candidates around the country.
And that almost never happens, that disparity being, first of all, in that direction and being that much, right?
Well, not in recent history, that's right.
What do you think it's going to mean in terms of the numbers? I mean, begin with the retirees and then move to contests which maybe we never imagined would be, you know, toss-ups.
Well, let's look on the Senate side, for instance. I mean, the Republicans are basically ceding races in Virginia, in Colorado, and New Mexico, where you have Republican senators retiring. And, of course, you have Ted Stevens with his legal troubles in Alaska, a state that hasn't had a Democratic senator in decades. You know, the Liddy Dole in North Carolina is in serious trouble. And, of course, all eyes are on Georgia for good reasons, in large part because of the distinct possibility of a runoff, which could keep the final number in terms of Senate races and how many seats the Democrats have unknown until December 2nd or 3rd.
You know, we were talking with some people at our member stations down in some of these areas where the races are that you're talking about here. And it's come up in the last few days, the issue of the Democrats taking a 60-seat control of the Senate as working its way into the actual campaign itself, that Republicans are saying, hey, whatever you think of me, don't, you know, vote to give the Democrats this much control in Congress. Is that having an impact?
It's hard to know. It certainly is something that they've seized on as, you know, to try and turn it around. I mean, there's some interesting things about the number 60. First of all, it's not as magical as a lot of people would think, that getting, you know, 60 senators together on any one issue is tough for any party, even if they've got the 60th or 61st seat. The other thing is that Democrats have really raised, I mean, this may be the cloud in all this for them, is they've really raised those expectations so high. And it's hard. I mean, to get to 60, they've got to run the board, basically, in all the states where they're ahead and where what are rated now by analysts as toss-ups, and then pick up either Georgia, Mississippi, or Kentucky, where their candidates are still behind. So it's not an easy road to 60 to begin with. And even once you've got it, it doesn't mean that you just get to do whatever you want in the Senate. Former Vice President Walter Mondale laughed about these sorts of ads that you're describing, saying, oh, if they get 60, they're going to get whatever they want. Because, of course, he and President Carter had that majority when they were in the White House. And he said, trust me, from my experience, you don't have to worry about it.
That's interesting. You know, there's an eerie echo of 2000 in all of this. Bill Clinton was seen as having questionable coattails back in 2000, although he did campaign. George Bush appears to have no coattails at all. And Dick Cheney's foray into the campaign over the weekend was something that Barack Obama made hay of in his stump speech. Give me an assessment of the coattails situation right now.
Well, I mean, the really amazing thing is to see how the Democrats have so many surrogates, right? Bill Clinton was out campaigning. You have actors and celebrities. I mean, Hillary is out campaigning. You know, there are so many people the Democrats can turn to right now. President Bush is basically sidelined. The vice president is sidelined. You look around and you try to find, you know, who out there can help out these Republican candidates. And it certainly doesn't seem to be John McCain. I spent a lot of time in New Hampshire, you know, where he won two primaries. And if anything, John Sununu, the senator, who's in his own tough re-election fight, is helping to carry McCain along.
Wow. David, so breakfast in your house, what is it, mini-wheats or oatmeal?
That's right.
Which one?
Cheerios.
Cheerios. Thank you. David Herzenhorn, New York Times reporter, speaking to us from his home in Washington, D.C. Great story on the difficulties for the GOP in the congressional races, both in the House and the Senate. That's in the New York Times today. We're going to end this segment talking about the McCain campaign. And joining us is Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein. Andrea, you've been in Western Ohio or Eastern Ohio and Western Pennsylvania assessing voters who are very much in play. Let me play for you this sort of over the weekend stump speech of John McCain, which really sort of sums up where he's at emotionally at this point.
America faces a big choice, and there's just one day left. Pundits have written us off just like they've done before, and my opponent is measuring the drapes in the White House. They may not know it, but the Mac is back.
Andrea Bernstein, is the Mac back?
Well, I haven't seen so much of the Mac. I missed the Mac. The Mac was a lot of fun to talk to. This Mac stays in the front of his campaign plane and seals himself off, and the voters know it. Lots of Republicans said to me, I would have voted for Mac, but Mac hasn't been around this time around.
So the McCain campaign has seven stops today, and they're in places that you wouldn't expect. I particularly love Roswell, New Mexico, where John McCain is going. But anyway, what do you think the strategy is at this point, in any sense of the mood and the sort of resources that the campaign is putting into these final moments?
I think the problem for John McCain is that he made his bed and today he's having to lie in it. I mean, you know, he's in Pittsburgh today. Hillary Clinton is in Pittsburgh. They made Pennsylvania a big area of focus for their campaign. Basically, they said, okay, we're going to offset Obama's gains in Virginia, Iowa, and some of these other states with the electoral-rich state of Pennsylvania. And, you know, there were some reasons for it. I mean, you know, I had a conversation, interesting conversation with Governor Ed Rendell before one of the debates. You know, we've seen a lot of sort of open and covert racism in our counties that count tour. People can go on the takeaway.org and listen to that if they want. And I asked Governor Rendell, and the first thing he said was, I told him that during the primary. And then he said, look, if someone is drowning in the river and someone sticks out an arm to save you, you're not checking to see the color of that arm. And that seems to be what has obtained here in Pennsylvania in a race that remains significantly ahead for Obama, even as it's tightening in these last few days.
What about the national strategy? Why is John McCain apparently needed in states that we presumably wouldn't have thought would be contested?
Well, you know, when Sarah Palin got up and gave her speech at the convention, where she started talking about small-town America, fundamental miscalculation from the McCain campaign is there aren't enough voters in small towns to win. And what they need to do is appeal to a sense of America that it has of itself, sort of a upstanding rural nation. This is something that goes back to Jefferson. That's where the good morals lie. But, you know, some of these towns that he was in yesterday, I drove through Hanoverton, Ohio, took about a minute to get through. And even then I saw a sign that said, you can take my sign, but not my vote, Obama. He's not getting 100% of the voters. And then he comes to a place like Pittsburgh, which is a big city. It has African-Americans. It has Latinos. It's mostly white, but it still has a lot of unions, a lot of working class people. And they've created this us versus them thing, which hasn't worked. And they've lost the suburbs. They've lost the independents. They've lost the Republican Party elites, the people that listen to Colin Powell and Lawrence Eagleburger. And it's all in all a very bad picture going into Election Day for the McCain campaign.
Well, again, thank you, Andrea Bernstein. She's assessing the political picture for us. Andrea Bernstein, Takeaway political director, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where she is in the battleground zone between Ohio and Pennsylvania, and will be there for us all of today and then be back tomorrow. We have a slogan for this campaign. Try this on for size.
Hi, my name is Max, and I want to suggest for a slogan for the new election, death or glory.
Death or glory, don't, just another story.
Like the Clash song.
You can do it too at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We got one more day, just one more day until the presidential election, until the voting actually takes place, the election day voting, that is. Give us your slogan.
Good morning. This is Chris from Brooklyn. I've been thinking about the slogan, and the only thing I can come up with is T-G-I-O. Thank goodness it's over.
One day more.
That's right. Call us with your own slogan at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. With me is Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor of Essence Magazine. And how many times did you see Lemiz?
Thousands.
Thousands of times.
Thousands.
Anyway, I wish you were all in the studio with us here because we're having a great discussion of the politics and the anticipation of this day. And it's the case that we've talked almost cheaply about the historical value of this election. It's historic in 50,000 different ways.
Cynically, I would say.
Cynically, maybe superficially, but actually the path to this moment has been blazed by some really important African-American women.
Indeed. Indeed. Especially one, Charlotta Bass, who's been all but forgotten by history.
No relation to you,
No
right?
relation to me, much to my chagrin. I was hoping to hit her up for some money. I discovered she's no longer living. And I was also trying to figure out this whole journalism thing. Like when I came across her name when I'm working on a book about the black press, and I saw, you know, Charlotta Bass and the California Eagle. I was very interested in that because it's a black paper, but the paper that gets the most acclaim is the Los Angeles Sentinel.
Uh-huh.
And then I discovered that this woman had run, for national office as the vice presidential nominee in 1952 on the Progressive Party ticket. Now, my grandparents were huge Henry Wallace fans, you know, so they talked about Henry Wallace a lot, you know, who was a 1948 Progressive ticket nominee, defeated by Truman, but they never talked about Charlotta Bass, and that's like our last name.
And before you get into the character, you know, describing who she is, the Progressives weren't some fringy out of their party. I mean, they were a significant part of the election.
They were very substantial. They got over a million votes, you know, in 1948. Now, Wallace did walk away from the party. People tried to label them communists. You know, this was during the height of the McCarthy era, you know, witch hunts and scares. But they weren't. I mean, they had a great number of issues that people cared about. And Charlotta Bass was a huge Republican before she joined the Progressive Party.
Well, this is a quote from Charlotta Bass from an actor in a documentary from 1988 called The Black Press. And here is some of the words of Charlotta Bass talking about allegations during the campaign that are very eerily reminiscent of what we're going through today.
No, my friends, not communism, but common greed on the part of the rich and powerful and their newspaper, radio, and speaking puppets is what keeps us, the people, divided and weak.
Dare I
slaves.
Say, dare I say, mainstream media?
Exactly. And John was fascinated about Charlotta Bass. At that time, she was 70. And she was a true maverick. You know, so she had parallels with someone else. A Time magazine then run by Henry Luce called her dumpy and domineering. And she paid a heavy price for her association with the Progressive Party ticket. I mean, she had been labeled a communist. You know, they tried to get her to testify during the un-American activities. You know, she eventually
she was blacklisted.
She blacklisted. Went bankrupt, was in ill health, died, you know, in 1969. And her memory just sort of vanished along with it.
What were her political origins?
She started out as a Republican in Los Angeles, and she really was an activist. You know, she was involved in just about, you know every type of cause, including, you know, migrant workers' rights. Also, she led the charge to ban Birth of a Nation from films. You know, she was, you know, very much against, you know, stereotypical roles in films. She fought for actresses like Hattie McDaniel and Louise Beavers to have better roles. I mean, she had her hand in a whole bunch of different pots and was consistent, very much organized and an organizer. She broke ranks from the Republican Party after her nephew was killed in World War II, moved over to the Progressive Party, where W.E.B. Du Bois seconded her nomination. She was nominated by Paul Robeson.
Hmm. And this was a moment when the Republicans were associated with emancipation.
Absolutely.
But were having trouble maintaining those credentials. But the Democratic Party was by no means a place for African Americans.
She felt very uncomfortable with the Dixiecrats, as many, you know, African Americans did. And she was very much like, in keeping with African American women and their huge role in the political process, like Daisy Bates, who was the real, you know, real brains behind the Little Rock Nine, a group who, you know, desegregated Central High. She was a publisher, so she wrote editorials, stinging editorials that her viewers came to every week. And I'm convinced that she paved the way not only for people like Fannie Lou Hamer, who was, you know, so critical to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, you know, the 1963 Atlantic showing that they did in Atlantic City, but also Shirley Chisholm, who I think we've not talked about enough during this.
Well, if 1952 campaign is Charlotta Bass, 1972 brings you Shirley Chisholm and this brand of African American political progressive rhetoric and eloquence.
I think that if Americans, whether they're white, black, pink, green, if just plain Americans would commit themselves on the basis of their deeds and their actions to really moving in terms of eliminating these obstacles that prevent us from communicating with each other and moving, they say, a nation of people, we won't have to talk about these things, but we're going to have to continue to create legislation or what have you that at least will protect those who need the most protection, as hopefully someday in the future we won't have to talk about these things.
Right. Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm took on her entire party to run for president in 1972.
Absolutely. And she's not an asterisk. I mean, I really do think that she has a foothold in history. And I think that she's going to be remembered far more kindly, you know, years from now than she is at this moment. But ironically enough, the second African-American Illinois senator was Carol Moseley Braun, who also ran for president of the United States.
Right.
You know, she had a couple of slip ups along the way, but mounted, you know, the type of she often cited Shirley Chisholm when she was running for office. I mean, you know, she didn't have the complexity of character, I think, that Shirley Chisholm had, you know, or the fortitude that Charlotta Bass had, but they certainly paved the way. And I think Fannie Lou Hamer is critical in that triumvirate of Bass, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Shirley Chisholm.
When I think about Barack Obama's eloquence and success as a candidate, it is this complexity and eloquence that I associate with Shirley Chisholm that comes through.
Oh, absolutely. He's almost like the surrogate son of Shirley Chisholm and also an outsider within his own party.
Right.
I mean, you know, like 20 months ago when Barack Obama said he was running for president of the United States, across barbershops and beauty parlors in Black America, people were saying, "You're running for what?" You know, and here we come to this moment. Yeah, I think something's going to happen tomorrow, right? Isn't something happening on tomorrow?
That would be election day.
It would be interesting to see what's going to happen.
Well, they're not saying running for what anymore.
No, not at all.
If Shirley Chisholm was here, I wonder what she'd say.
And actually, I think somewhere there are two people smiling, Charlotta Bass and Lyndon Baines Johnson.
All right. Patrick Henry Bass, takeaway contributor and senior editor at Essence, is with me in the studio. We'll have more on The Takeaway right after this.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I guess it's news that Wall Street opened this morning is tiptoeing its way to Election Day. Headlines from Femi Okeh now.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 27 minutes to the top of the hour. Also getting some more details in from the second war crimes trial at Guantanamo Bay. A jury has found the propagandist for Osama bin Laden, his name is Ali Hamza al-Balu, guilty of conspiracy, solicitation to commit murder, and supporting terrorism. Each sentence carries a possibility of a life sentence in prison. So each crime carries a possibility of a life sentence in prison. And there are a record number of kids on medication for obesity-related conditions. And this comes from a new study from the American Academy of Pediatrics. Prescriptions for diabetes have doubled since 2002. A Chinese envoy is calling his visit to Taiwan crucial. He'll be the highest-ranking official to visit Taiwan since the nearly 60-year-old split. And the two areas, the two regions, will talk about fiscal and transit policy. And that's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So take time out of your busy day. Pick up 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can match wits with our friend Kent from Chestnut Ridge.
Hi, this is Kent from Chestnut Ridge. I can't help looking backwards, and all I can think of is the king is dead. I don't even want to say long live the king. That's my take on this election.
Call it a take, call it a slogan. Send it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org and sum up the last 20 months. With a day to go, you might be a little tired of all the political polls out there, so we're really not going to talk about the poll numbers in this segment. But we did bring in David Leonhardt, economics columnist and blogger from The New York Times, to talk about what's on the New York Times economics blog. That's economics with an X. We're asking readers, it's asking readers to look into their crystal balls and come up with a few predictions about Tuesday's election results and put them into what's called a predictions market. David, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be back.
Describe what prediction markets are, how they work, and why they're correct.
Well, one of the best things about prediction markets is actually how old they are. We think of them as being as having been invented with the internet, but in fact they've been around for centuries. People have been betting on the presidential election for years and years. People bet on the selection of a new pope in the 16th century. And essentially what happens is it's like the stock market. People buy and sell contracts that are tied to an event. In this case, the event would be something like John McCain wins the election. And if John McCain in fact wins the election, the contract will pay $10, and if he doesn't, it'll pay nothing.
And like credit default swaps, they're unregulated, but unlike credit default swaps, they're absolutely public.
They are public, and so they exist on the internet. So you can go to these sites, and one of the best known one is probably InTrade, and you can look at the prices of these contracts, and they tell you pretty directly what the traders think the odds are of what's going to happen. So right now, the Obama contract suggests that people think there's about an 88-89% chance he's going to win the election, and the McCain contract suggests people think there's about an 11 or 12% chance he's going to win the election.
Now, aside from just an idle game, why should we pay attention to this?
Well, so the question is, do we pay attention to any of this horse race stuff? And I'm an economics writer, so I spend much more of my time looking at policies and issues and stuff like that. But the horse race stuff is interesting and fun as well, as long as you keep it in its proper perspective. And one of the nice things about these prediction markets is they try to synthesize all that poll information that's out there. And they really, over the last few years, have an incredibly good record. And I want to be clear, their record is not perfect, and they're only odds. So just because there's a greater than 50% chance likelihood of something doesn't mean it's going to happen all the time. But in 2004, these prediction markets had greater than 50% odds on every state that Bush actually won and the flip for Kerry. So if you looked at a state in 2004 and said, oh, there's a 60% chance George Bush is going to win it, he won that state. The same thing happened in 2006 with the Senate race, and it was really interesting on election night in 2006. If you had been following the odds on InTrade, because they change over the course of the night, just like market prices change in the stock market, you actually would have been ahead of the TV networks. The TV networks were about an hour behind InTrade's odds in figuring out the Democrats, in fact, were going to take back the Senate. So what we did is we took some of these odds and we invited our readers. There's no money involved whatsoever, but we invited our readers to come onto our site and make some guesses based on their odds. And we said we'll give the winner a little bit of glory, and that's what we're giving out. It's also an attempt to test actually how good these odds are. I'm curious to see whether our readers are actually really good at sussing out the odds that are not realistic.
Well, specifically, you've got a list of questions on the economics website that announces this game, and you have to answer three questions and a tiebreaker, in order to play. What kinds of questions are people going to be asked to answer?
So there are a couple of obvious ones, like who's going to win.
Right.
And so if you pick John McCain and he does win, you get almost 7 points, whereas if you pick Barack Obama and he wins, you only get 1.2 points because, again, the odds are different.
Got it.
But there are also some curveball ones, like will Bob Barr, the independent candidate, get more or less than 1% of the vote? Will voter turnout be less than or greater than 65%? We do about 7 swing states in the presidential election, and we do about 7 Senate races, the ones that people are really focused on, like Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell, the Republican incumbent, is still very much a favorite, so you'd get fewer points if you pick him and he wins than if you pick Lunsford, his Democratic challenger, and Mississippi with the special election, and in some ways one of the most interesting Senate races. I don't know if you all have talked about this angry debate yesterday, but the Minnesota Senate race between Norm Coleman, the Republican incumbent, and Al Franken, the Democratic challenger.
Yeah, not a lot of laughs there.
No.
Now, is it possible for you to track bizarre scenarios? In other words, does voting occasionally come in and spike on strange things like, you know, Osama bin Laden is president or you know, who knows?
Yes. And it's really hard to know how much to make of this. Was this just a complete fluke or not? But this site doesn't just do political contracts, and there are other sites like it. It also does some other things. It does the Oscars, and it had a contract for a while. This is obviously before he was captured. Will Saddam Hussein be captured or killed? And in the days before Saddam Hussein was captured, the price of the contract really changed, and it spiked from about 9% to about 30%. I think he had to be captured by the end of that calendar year.
Now, could that have been because soldiers were playing it from Iraq?
I mean, anything's possible. So that's the idea here. The idea here is that if you have enough money moving around in these markets, someone who actually has knowledge, whether it's soldiers or whether it's someone in back here in the Pentagon or who knows what, is actually going to be trading this stuff.
All right. So basically, David, we want you to violate all of your journalistic ethics, okay, and find out if any of the McCain staffers are playing the game for the Obama side, okay? And then disclose them to us exclusively? Could you do that for us?
Well, that's really interesting because the McCain price on Intrade
5 seconds
was much higher than anywhere else, and people think McCain supporters were bidding it up.
The speculation is endless. The game is on the New York Times website, the economics blog. David Leonhard is the economics columnist for the New York Times. So go to the New York Times website and bid on the election. We'd love to know if takeaway audience members can affect the outcome one way or another. And we need a slogan. I keep telling you, we need a slogan for this election campaign.
My slogan for this campaign is, yes, we can versus no, you don't.
Match wits with our listeners by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. A lot of history. A lot of listeners needed to bring it home.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm with Patrick Henry Bass, Takeaway contributor and senior editor of Essence. We got one more day till the presidential election.
Is that tomorrow?
That's tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
And once it's over, how are you going to remember the good and the bad times?
My name is Frederick. Here's how I sum up this campaign. The worn-out maverick versus the new kid in town.
Or what Philomena offers.
A breakthrough campaign.
For these people, their minds are made up. But not so for Andrew Kupka.
Undecided and it feels so lonely.
Well, let's see how lonely it does feel. Andrew joins us from Atlanta. You know, we gave you your own theme, Andrew.
I like that. Wrote a song and everything for me. That's great.
Isn't that nice? We don't want to make fun of this idea of being undecided, but it is just a day before the election.
Right.
And I'm wondering what you're looking for to make the light bulb go off.
What I'm looking for is to just get a final sense of who I think is best ready to lead the country over the next 4 years, especially in these uncertain times that we're living in economically.
Now, I've talked to you many times over the past several weeks, and my impression of you is that if John McCain hadn't gotten you a long time ago, it's a sign of a real failing in his campaign. Am I wrong to have that impression?
No, that would be quite accurate. Going back to the Republican primaries, I was a Rudy Giuliani guy till he dropped out, and then I was kind of left with a whole lot of nothing. And McCain never was able to bridge that in my mind.
So what would be the heartbreak of, and I'm not campaigning here.
Right.
What would be the heartbreak of voting for, say, Barack Obama?
I wouldn't put, if I voted for Barack Obama, it wouldn't be a heartbreak. There are a lot of good things about that man. It's his policies that worry me.
Now, you have said repeatedly that you have never been this undecided before.
Right.
Who do you think you represent in America?
I think I represent a lot of Americans that, you know, come from a conservative economic base, for one, and also consistent conservative values. Now, I'm not religious right or anything, but just consistent conservative values. And that's where John McCain, I think, loses a whole bunch of base support.
Well, Andrew, as you know, we're fighting off the Leno Show and Letterman and Saturday Night Live. We're trying to get you to decide on their air, correct?
They haven't left me alone all weekend.
They haven't let they. All right, so we've sent a team down to make sure that you do it on our air, okay? You're going to stick with that promise, right?
Absolutely, if they buy me breakfast.
All right, no problem there. We can definitely do that. Any chance I can call you Andy?
No, still no.
No, I can't call you Andy. All right, well, good luck there. You've got a lot of work to do. We're going to be checking with you later today from our team down in Atlanta, and we're also going to have you on the program tomorrow, okay? What time do you think you're going to vote?
It will be in the morning. Yeah, with daylight savings and everything, getting up in the morning is not an issue now.
So you're going to have to decide on tomorrow's program, right?
I'm going to let you guys know first as I make the decision.
All right, Andrew Kupka, undecided voter from Atlanta, Georgia. Just one more day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We begin with headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Politicians up and down the ballot are getting their final pitches in before Election Day tomorrow. Barack Obama will be in Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia. John McCain visits Florida, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, and Indiana today. Syria shut down an American school in retaliation to an American raid on its soil. The strike targeted what's thought to be a network smuggling foreign fighters into Iraq. UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown wants more economic leadership from America. At an oil conference in the Middle East, he called on the next president to think globally and steer clear of protectionism. A Vermont woman's case against Wyeth Pharmaceuticals goes before the Supreme Court today. Diana Levine lost her arm because the medication was improperly injected. A Vermont jury awarded Levine $6.7 million, and a court will decide whether the government can limit lawsuits by consumers harmed by prescription drugs. And South Africa has a new political party, and those angry at Thabo Mbeki's ousting have broken off from the ruling African National Congress. And finally, when you think of Salzburg, Austria, you think it's the home of Mozart, the setting for The Sound of Music, and now the sound of heavy metal music.
Okay. There you go. Now you're talking.
You woken up yet?
Now you're talking.
That's Slayer, one of the groups up for study as part of the first academic heavy metal conference.
In Salzburg, Mozart's home.
Academics will be studying Nordic metal, hardcore, grindcore. It's the first heavy fundamentalisms conference in Salzburg.
I love the Nordic metal. I love it.
I like grindcore.
Thank you, Femi.
You've been warned.
Oh, yes, and as the heavy metal fades into my cranium, do you know all about this early voting taking place, Patrick? I mean, 31 states, 24% of Americans have already voted in some states. It's well over 50% of the number of people who voted in 2004. Listen to this and tell me if you know, tell me what you think it means.
I was ready to walk away, and my older sister said, don't even think about it. You're going to stay here, and we're going to vote today.
I pretty much decided to early vote on a whim. I was walking on campus, and they stopped me and told me, did you know you could early vote today?
Extreme crowdedness, 1.5 to 2 hour wait.
I'd never really experienced people talking to me at the polls before or asking me questions or inquiring about how I was voting on, not just about the president, but other issues.
My county is a pretty Republican county. We will vote Republican, but it was really neat when I went to vote, the 12 or so people that were voting, it really was people from all walks of life, and it was a pretty good cross-section.
Those voices of early voters make a great point. Forget polls. We already have millions of Americans who have gone to the polls and give us an indication of what it's going to be like tomorrow. They're all participated in America's Exit Poll right here on The Takeaway.
Yeah, and I like hearing a Republican say the word neat.
Joining us now is Michael McDonald, Associate Professor of Government and Politics at George Mason University, to tell us what early voting means. And he's also a part of something called the United States Election Project. Dr. McDonald, thanks for being with us.
Oh, great to be with you.
First of all, where are you this morning?
I am at an undisclosed location next to Dick Cheney's cave where we run the exit polls.
Interesting. All right, what does early voting mean in terms of what to expect tomorrow?
Well, we've already had somewhere around 28 million people that we can document have already voted in this election. And the polls indicate that, and some of the information that we're getting from the states where we have demographic or partisan registration information about these voters is that they look to be overwhelmingly breaking towards Barack Obama. And that's a departure from previous elections. Usually Republicans do very well among early voters. ABC Washington Post poll in 2004 had Bush winning by about 60% to 40% in early voters. And this year they find an exact reversal of that, where Obama is winning 60% to 40%. We've seen very high volume of early voting in some states. We've already broken records in Georgia. We've already tripled the number of early voters from 2004. So we are seeing a tremendous amount of voting already taking place in some states that have more permissive early voting laws. And so as that vote piles up in some of these key battleground states, and it looks to be breaking favorably for Obama, if all those things are correct, then it's going to be very difficult for McCain to come from behind in some of these states in the last days of the election here.
Michael McDonald, let me just make a knee-jerk conclusion and deconstruct it for me. Okay, fine. So the Democrats are all voting early. The Republicans will vote on the day of. So it'll all balance out.
That's very possible. That's very possible that we're going to see, again, this reversal of a trend that we've seen over the last 20 years of early voting, which is that we may see the Republicans vote in higher numbers on Election Day versus the Democrats voting early. And there are some indications that there are indeed people who would have voted on Election Day anyway are the sorts of people who are energized to get out there now and vote for Obama. However, we also have some indications there are some people out there who are not high-propensity voters who are showing up at the polls. We've got new registrants. We've got some young people. And I think most notably, and this will be a trend to really watch on election night, is African-Americans. If you look across the country, where we do have these statistics, you're seeing African Americans turn out at elevated levels beyond anything that we've seen in recent American politics. So,
correct, Dr. McDonald, because there were like 600,000 African Americans who were registered to vote in 2004 who didn't go to vote. And now they're even like there's the estimation there are twice those numbers who are now registered to vote.
Yeah,
new voters.
Yeah, I don't have the registration statistics right at my fingertips, but we're seeing as a share of the early vote, African Americans in some of these southern states that have to track this sort of information for the Voting Rights Act, in some of these southern jurisdictions, we're seeing African Americans outpace their share of the 2004 entire electorate by about 8 percentage points in some of these southern states. And that's just remarkable. And then you look at some of the urban counties that are out there where we don't have the race statistics, but we know that these are high African American population counties. Again, you're seeing this real uptick in early voting in these urban counties. And again, so you look across the country, you look at places like Franklin County and Cuyahoga County, two of the Democratic strongholds in Ohio, where the numbers look to be at over 20% now, perhaps, of the voters in those counties have already voted.
Wow.
And this actually could make a big difference on Election Day. I mean, not only does now the Obama campaign not have to go out and try and recruit these people to go vote on Tuesday, but also they're going to be shorter lines because they've processed more people already, and that could help because we traditionally in the last few elections had problems with long lines in some of these urban areas. We may not have that problem as much in states where we do have early voting in place.
Michael McDonald, a dumb question and a curious question. If you could answer them quickly, please. What do you think this bodes for the overall turnout for this election compared with other elections in the last century? And what do they do with early votes? Are they tabulated immediately, or are they counted on Election Day with all the rest of the votes?
Yeah, let me first answer the second question, which is by law, we have to count all these votes on Election Day.
Right.
And so you go back to 1845, we set a single day to hold elections in the United States, and the Supreme Court has ruled specifically on whether early voting is constitutional or abides by federal law. They said that and I love this word, it's such a great word, they say the election has to be consummated on Election Day. So even though people are voting now and they're casting those votes will not actually be opened up and looked at until Election Day. Now, the second part of the question, or the first part of the question, was about where this is placed in historical context. And
quickly,
we look at this election, we're going to beat the 60% turnout among those eligible in 2004, excuse me. And so you have to go back to the next highest turnout. I think that we may beat the 1960 turnout of 63.8%. And if so, we go all the way back to 1908 to find the next highest turnout level, and that was 65.7%. So
100
we
years.
May really see 100 years.
100 years is
politics.
A nice round number. Dr. Michael McDonald, Associate Professor of Government and Politics at George Mason University, and he runs the Election Project. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And we're going to give you guys the last word.
I'm Lawrence Trailer from Nawa, Connecticut. The old bomber versus Obama.
My name is John Parker, calling from New Orleans. My slogan for the campaign this year is brains over brawn.
Send us your slogan at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, this is Marcy from Setauket, New York, and in the spirit of the great Dr. Seuss, my idea for a slogan is one date, two wait, red state, blue state.
Oh, nice. Or try Carrie's. She has an email. A legal tome, a garden gnome. That's her suggestion for sloganizing this campaign at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Political Director Andrea Bernstein is going to be part of our political coverage on our website. Send your photos, videos, and stories of all your voting process to thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.